can be directed any specific member of the panel or the panel as a whole, but the panel of course reserves the right to make comments on each other's comments. Please.
So I'd like to raise a topic for Professor Thielen. You referred to the crowding out of private science by the government science industry. But I think, from my point of view, we use much stronger words than crowding out, in that many aspects of government science are really self-referencing industries, extracting taxpayer money through promotion of their points in political life. In aggregate, are fundamentally committing scientific fraud. The global warming industry is Exhibit A. Last year, we had a recent presentation by Peter Duesberg suggesting that the HIV research industry was another of those exhibits. You can also take the point of view that there's a massive misallocation of resources based on what's politically popular. The whole space program in America is, from a scientific point of view, wasted a vast amount of money versus the other alternatives for space research. And I suspect that the cancer research industry is a self-referencing, largely misdirected research field where tens of billions of dollars are being spent. So this is fraud and massive misallocation of resources. I'd like you to comment on that.
Okay, well, are you going to add eugenics to that? Early half of this century, all scientists said that eugenics is really important. We had to go around sterilizing the mentally defected. It's all based on false understanding of recessive genes, which everyone usually thinks. Yes, the thing about scientists is that it's a mistake to believe scientists believe in falsification. Scientists are advocates. They have points of view they're trying to foster, and competitors disagree with them. But scientists have to ignore falsification, because when you're at the forefront of knowledge, lots of facts come along that you don't understand. And if you accepted them as having falsified what you were doing, you wouldn't proceed. I couldn't talk at length, but let me just say that scientists have to ignore inconvenient data if they're going to do what they want to do, because ultimately inconvenient data can be explained away if you're right. And if the incentives are wrong, and they are in science, if governments fund science without any measurable outcome, just on the assumption that somehow it will translate to economic growth 10 years down the line, so they can never be held to account, then scientists will indeed take as much money as they can to produce their own papers, to refer to each other nicely, to give each other prizes, with no external references. Science is potentially a very corrupt activity, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a Green for Professor Van Loon. Frank, I enjoyed your talk and shared with us excellent observations about the nature of conflicts and gave us a definition of crime and so on. But to me, it sounded a bit like foreplay, and it seemed that you stopped just at the moment when the action became exciting. That is, what is the punishment that would fit the crime, and would you sort of lean towards Rothbard and Lestalionis and double Lestalionis, or Randy Barnett and pure restitution and so on? This is what I would have liked reading the title of your talk, but this is what I'd like to hear. Now, it's unfair to ask you to do a conference that your talk that you didn't give, but could you, you know, give us rapidly whether you are on one side or the other of the debate, or maybe in between?
Okay, of course the occasion was limited to 30 minutes, and I dislike the idea to rush through to a conclusion that is not evident from what has been said before. And so I just laid out the groundwork for the arguments, and hopefully those of you who are interested will develop from there and go find the conclusion. Now, as to your specific questions, whether I am on this side or another side, I think I can claim to be a side of my own, so I do not have to choose between two set camps. As I said, punishment to me is a compounded negative, so there is no justification at all for punishment, although there could be, there can be reasons for it, because say it is a good policy of deterrence, or it is a good method for teaching kids discipline and so on. But as a response to crime, the only proper response to crime is restitution. And when restitution falls short, when there is no full restitution, and that means full, not just the harm done when the deed was done, but also the consequences as well. But when full restitution and compensation falls short, and there is no repentance on the part of the tortfeasor or the criminal to make whole amends or to make things whole again, then I think the threat of punishment and the punishment, the infliction of punishment becomes justified. But it is justified in the same way and for the same reason. I'm talking as a philosopher, so it probably doesn't make sense to anybody else, but it is justifiable for the same reason that you have to use force and harsh measures to teach a beast, right? Mm. If someone cuts out of the process of doing justice and maintaining justice, so he refuses to go into the argument, then of course, when reason fails, you can only use force, right? And now for some, in some cases, that moment may be come very rapidly, and in other moments that, in other cases, that moment may be very remote, so there's no particular thing. As to the harshness of the punishment, I think the punishment, first of all, the right of inflicting the punishment is with the victim, right? But one has also have to consider that maybe the criminal or the tortfeasor or whatever you want to call him has obligations against other persons who are innocent of the crime. And in inflicting punishment, I think that the basic limit or the essential limit is that you do not, by your punishment, inflict harm or damage or invade or harm or diminish the rights of other innocent persons, that I think. For the rest, as I said, most crimes happen in contexts which are much more richer in content than the pure Rothbardian or Randy Barnettian, whatever context. So the ideas people have of what is effective and what is proper will of necessity be determined in the peculiar context, and they will not be influenced in any way by whatever may be said in a place such as this.
A question for Professor Hoppe. The flow of money we can say is quite complicated. Can really be figured out which taxes pay for the construction of streets. Thus, put to the extreme, your proposition might suggest that everyone who buys a chewing gum because pays a sales tax acquires a microscopic title to every street within the respective nation state, thus acquires the right to free entry, to make it very cheap. So I wonder where would you set the limit? And which role would residency play compared to the amount of money that you pay in taxes?
some extent, I can continue what Franz von Nunn said. I don't think it is too wise to try to be too precise in all of these matters. My friend Walter Block tends to be on the side that he thinks that you can hammer out a priori solution to any type of legal complication that arises. My purpose was only to indicate the principles that are involved in all of this, to recognize that there can be such things as easements or no easements. In the case of streets, you typically do have easements. In all concrete situations, I think this I would leave up to the profession of lawyers. Profession of lawyers is, of course, currently in a status environment blown up to huge proportions, but lawyers, judges, arbitrators, and so forth will play a great role in any type of society. So all detailed decisions I would leave up to two boards of experts who would decide how to apply these principles that I laid down. I did not want to do more than just make obvious what major principles are involved. The application of principles is sometimes a tricky, difficult field. I try to abstain from things like this unless I have a concrete situation in front of me, and then I will consult with people, and I believe that a reasonable application of the principles can be found to the case, in the same way as Frank basically emphasized too. There can be cultural context that make a certain crime be judged in this way, in this place, and the same type of deed would be treated slightly differently or somewhat differently in a different cultural context.
Can I just say something a little bit about restitution? I mean, I have experience of a fair number of criminals, admittedly they're British criminals. But what I can say with restitution is I wish you luck with them. Because I don't think the administration of restitution will be very easy with them.
I agree that in most cases you will have either because of poverty or because of simple lack of any scruples on the part of the person. So I do not rule out punishment. As I said, sometimes the moment of punishment is very close, and sometimes it is very remote. But I was not addressing specific cases, and there are cases of fraud, for example, and theft, which are not committed by the underclass in which you specialize. So sometimes restitution is indeed advised, I would say.
Yeah. In the case of Mr. Madoff, I think he needs a sentence of longer than 150 years to be paid for the restitution. I think it's, in fact, restitution, while I'm not against restitution, of course, the fact is that it's, it will play a very, I think, a very small part of the in the criminal administration.
Anthony Daniels once wrote in an article that half the people in prison shouldn't be there, and the other half should never be let out. And I just thought that was right.
I have a question for Tom DiLorenzo. Your account of what happened reminded me a little bit of what happened after the moon landings, and the task was found, instead of dissolving NASA,
task, new task was found, like building the space shuttle and dabbling into climate science. Was this the fact, was this the case with the army after the Civil War? There was an army without a task and a state newly in love with power, and they found a task. Or this is more of a was it just chance that it happened that way? And the related question is the private railroad transcontinental railroad. Was how long before all this happened? Have they already established it, or were they in the process of building it at the time? Were the others competitors who were just lazy and wanted to help from the government? A few more details about that.
I do address that in that book chapter that I was summarizing in my talk, that you know, one of the motivations for what happened to the Plains Indians was exactly that, that the war was ending, and even some of the most famous American generals were laid off, were just sent home. And so, with a new war, a new possible war against the Indians, it created career opportunities for the existing army. And so of course the army became a lobbyist for the Indian Wars as much as anything, because it meant continued pay and all the rest that goes along with it. And so I do mention that in the book chapter that I was talking about, and they were that was part of it. And just like any other government bureaucracy, or not even government bureaucracies, a lot of nonprofit groups too. The March of Dimes was created to help cure polio, and it's still around, as far as that goes, so it's sort of pretty natural. On the transcontinentals, the Great Northern Railroad that I mentioned was built in the late 1870s, after the Civil War, of course, and after the building of the government-subsidized railroads. And so, in my other writing, I just make the point that the free market did build the Transcontinental Railroad. It just did it a few years later. And so there was a market failure case was made for the subsidies to the Transcontinental Railroad, saying capital markets would never be sufficient. But James J. Hill proved that they were just a few years later. And of course, the ones that were built and were subsidized by government were horribly inefficient. Every politician in America wanted a separate rail line to his district in return for his votes. And so the rail line to the West Coast looked like a cobweb as opposed to James J. Hill's straight line across the Rocky Mountains. And so that's an answer to your question.
I have a question for Stephen and so on. Worldwide, the general intellectual property seems to be rolling along with gathering strength as it goes. Copyright periods are being extended, penalties are being increased, enforcement agencies are popping up all over the world. Is there any good news on the anti-intellectual property front that you can tell us about?
Well, I think in libertarian circles there's increasing awareness that it's not libertarian. And I think the internet has basically made some types of IP enforcement almost impossible. Is also good. But yes, it does continue to roll along. I mean, there are some movements among some groups, software types, people like this, that they do advocate for reducing protection. But, we have the ACTA coming up. We do have copyright terms and patents getting stronger all the time. So I don't think it's getting very much better right now.
Say you were to put your argument to the minister. Advantages to this, The researcher who gets the grant would employ a research assistant who will gain more knowledge. This research assistant may, and some will, in due course, produce a product which has a commercial application. He would say, we can't really quantify these effects, but our hunch is that the overall impact is advantageous for economic growth. Do you think that's the kind of answer you would give him?
I'd be anxious to meet a minister who could give such an articulate and intelligent answer. They're trying to say that sort of thing, but let me explain why they would be wrong. It might even be that the more and the better the scientists that are funded by the government, the greater the damage to the economy. Imagine an economy where there is no government funding of science, and all the best scientists are working in the industry, really helping the economy grow. And then the government comes along and creates the National Science Foundation, takes all the and is brilliantly organized, really discriminatory, takes all the best scientists out of industry, puts them in a separate foundation, gives them lots of money to produce lots of papers, which by the way no one outside the media field would ever read. And the result is to impoverish economic growth by taking the best researchers out of industry. The trouble is that government funding science simply seems only to crowd out private funding. There are these huge philanthropic organisations of the 19th century, Carnegie, Wellcome Trust. They're coming back in again now, Bill and Melinda Gates, for example, Warren Buffett, but that's only because of the perception of a shortage of funding. The problem is that there is no evidence that the model that you fund scientists independently of industry and somehow it trickles out to the industry and can be exploited. That model seems to be false. It's actually largely science within industry that's applicable. And don't forget, industry, 7% of all industrial research is in pure science. Industry understands the importance of pure science because it has subtle tacit implications. So yes, the minister would say that. And because of crowding out and because the model is wrong, because you need the scientists actually in industry itself, he would actually be wrong. But that's what he would say. Or she.
I was just curious if you have you any information on the reason why in Germany the Althoff system was so prestigious, which consisted precisely in being together only the famous scientists and the best scientists together in a national system.
Do you want to explain to everyone else what the system is, because not everyone understands that?
Well, it is exactly the sort of system where the government at one point, at the central, when Germany became a central state, and the need for industrialization asserted itself, the state organized under the directorship of Mr. Althoff, a system where all the best forces in science and research were, as it were, brought together in a single system with specialized research institutes and so on, which was funded by the state and which is often credited to the expansion of German power and influence at the time.
Do you mean the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes? Do you mean the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes?
Yes.
And then latterly, of course, they were known as the Max Planck. Let me tell you two very interesting things about German economic growth that they never tell you. In 1815, Germany, in terms of GDP per capita and level of industrialization, was only 75% of that of Britain's in 1815. 100 years later, in 1914, after Britain had been laissez-faire for 100 years, and Germany highly dirigiste with the Kaiser Wilhelm suits all the rest of it for 100 years, Germany still was only 75% of the level of GDP per capita and only 75% of the level of industrialization of Britain. Total failure to converge. It's just a myth that Germany in the 19th century had great economic growth. The Kaiser very famously said 2 or 3 months before the war broke out in 1914 that he had to go to war soon because so many of his potential enemies, such as Russia, were successfully converging on Britain, and Germany was lacking behind. And the other really interesting thing about Germany is many of the great German discoveries were actually not funded by the state.
Germans are fed a false history of their own country. In the motor car, the whole business of four cylinders and the invention of the motor car owed nothing to the state. Zeppelin, self-funded. Kekulé, self-funded. Many of the great German discoveries were absolutely in the market or philanthropic. And Germany's fed a false history of one economic success in the 19th century. Actually, one of the reasons there are so many German names in America is that millions and millions and millions of Germans had to leave Germany in the 19th century for simple facts of poverty. Germany did not do well economically relative to the leading countries, and many of its advantages and discoveries were actually made independent of the state.
In his example of how government-funded science diverts engineers from the private sector to the government sector, well, it need not divert engineers at all. The money that would have been spent on government science could have been spent on anything else. And we don't know what it would be, but it doesn't necessarily need to be private science, as far as that goes. And it'll be cause creativity and job creation in other parts of the economy. In other words, opportunity cost, the economic concept of opportunity cost, should be considered here. And it involves more than just an engineer working, not working for NASA, but working for some corporation instead. It's a little more global than that.
I have two questions. One is for President Jones. My question is, I think that it's sort of naive to think of the Indians and Indians, or most of the American Indians, as being some like people who are prepared to trade with everyone, and it all could have been resolved very peacefully. I think they had a different idea of property, which created a lot of problems. And they're pretty well documented, their violence against the European immigrants in the first place. Now, you could argue that that's reactive, that was then reacting to the presence of the European immigrants imposing themselves on the Indians' land, never mind the Indians were fighting each other all the time anyway. So I'm asking if taken to its logical conclusion, what you might be saying is that the Europeans never should have gone through the New World.
Never should have what?
Gone to the New World.
Oh. No, I didn't say that. And, I didn't say what you said in the first part of your thing when you referred to naive either. That's not what I said in my talk. So you sort of set up a straw man question there. I think there always was some degree of conflict, and there's been a lot of research on books written about this, a catalog, catalog the whole history of conflict between Indians and European immigrants in America. And the argument that I'm making is that it escalated exponentially during and after the American Civil War. But there were a lot, many instances of trade and cooperation that I mentioned in my talk. I didn't say that the Indians were sort of these naive do-gooders who only wanted to welcome the Europeans to their country and sell them corn or anything like that, as you sort of suggested in your question. But I think there were many examples of the alternative. I mentioned James J. Hill, who cooperated with Indians, trading with them for rights away across their land, livestock, and things like that. And in Canada didn't do the same thing that Americans did as far as massacring the Indians to make way for the railroads. So I don't deny that Indians, engage in bad behavior. I do find it really ridiculous, though, that we call the Indians savages when our own U.S. Army scalps women and children during the Indian Wars. Who's the savage there as far as the type of behavior? There was savagery on both sides. And I just made the argument that putting the standing army there was essentially a form of corporate welfare for the railroad corporations. And I cite the words of General Sherman himself in saying that he considered that to be his new job after the end of the Civil War, to make way for the railroads.
So the Europeans shouldn't have come to New York.
Why not?
My other question is for Professor Keeler, actually. I was just wondering, what prevented the Wright brothers from licensing their airplanes and being able to develop aviation in America that way?
That is a very good question, because the British and the French and the Germans paid the license fees. But because the American government, Glenn Curtiss, the Smithsonian, all got together, all the Wright brothers' competitors got together to deny that the Wright brothers had flown first,
to claim that the American Smithsonian had flown first. They were constrained from getting licenses from the Wright brothers because that would deny their own claims and they got there first. And so all the Wright brothers' opponents were trapped. They couldn't apply for them, or they felt they couldn't apply for licenses because that would acknowledge the Wright brothers' patents and precedents. So by challenging the Wright brothers' patents, they removed themselves the ability to get the licenses. And so American aviation was simply silent. And the Wright brothers themselves were made miserable as sin because they spent their whole time. They stopped flying as well. The skies over America were empty. No one was flying.
I have some sort of concrete example for Dr. Hoffman. I'd like you to talk about the case of federation in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I'm a complete amateur on the subject, however, I know that when it came to apartments, it was fairly painless. People like my parents basically bought it from the government. Things became more complicated when it came to the issue of land, which, from what I understand, is the last natural resource. So in cases of companies like IKEA, they could own the building, but not the land on it, which causes all kinds of problems. So I'd like you to talk about how that sort of thing should have been resolved. Thank you.
I do have a little chapter in my Democracy, the Good God That Failed, that deals with the question of how to de-socialize previously socialistic countries. In cases like East Germany, for instance, where you had property titles and recordings still in existence, original ownership, specifically, should have been restituted, should have received their property back. In countries like Russia, where many records had been destroyed, that would obviously be more difficult to do. For those countries, again, there is no a prioristic theory how to do that. That requires also some sort of wisdom, but there are some basic rules. Those people who currently worked in various factories, and there was no previous owner which could be restored into his position, the current factory workers should become the owners of it, have shares that they can sell. So almost as the slogan of the communist, workers should own the factories, the farmers should own the land, and so forth. Except, of course, it must be a title that can be traded freely in the market to make it possible that this, again, a concentration of property in the hands of those that are entrepreneurially better and out of the hands of those who simply do not want to bear any risk but remain employees. In welfare states, the privatization is in a way easier. Because they also get recognized that all publicly owned goods have been produced with tax funds, and there exist tax records, so to speak, that would allow us to say how much did I pay in local taxes, how much did I pay in state taxes, how much did I pay in federal taxes. To the extent that these records can be produced, people would simply acquire a share according to their previous tax payments in these various public public goods. So restore those who have a valid title to the property. In those cases where there is no valid title or things get lost in history and we do not know who is the owner, then we use some sort of similar idea as the homesteading idea. The workers working in a factory have indeed, so to speak, homesteaded it, and they get an equal share that can be sold.
There's a question for Senator Kinsella. My mind is very sympathetic to Hawaii laws, my stomach always rebels. But how would that look? I suppose there would be Hawaii laws under a private law, or a private law society. And what is the line of argument for that? That there would be probably no Hawaii laws.
I don't understand the question.
The under private law society, private property society with competing laws with no monopoly, how would that society look concerning IP laws?
Oh, well, I think that you're describing a society where libertarian principles are widely recognized. That would be the only way to reach private law society in the first place. And of course, property rights would be strongly protected. So it would be seen that any type of proposal to have an IP right enforced would be just an infringement on property rights that already exist. So for example, if there's private property rights are widely respected and protected by whatever legal system exists in the private society, if someone tries to sue his neighbor for copying his idea, let's say, what he's asking the courts to do is to force his neighbor to give him some of his property. Well, presumably he owns his property in terms of money damages, let's say. Or to give him an injunction or an order telling this guy, you know, you can't use your printing press in a certain way, you can't do the X, Y, Z. So then the answer to the question is, well, who owns the property? Who owns the money of the defendant? The defendant owns the money. And unless you can justify that basically you've committed a crime or a contract, there's no justification for taking someone's property away. So basically, sanctity of property rights rules out the ability to have property rights and ideas and patterns. In fact, it's basically, it undercuts the homesteading rule as the basis of property. It's sort of a new homesteading rule. Instead of saying the first person who uses the property or is assigning the title down the line is the best claimant to this piece of this scarce resource, to make a successful IP claim, you would have to basically come up with a second rule, which is if someone owns a resource, if it can be used in a certain way according to an idea they came up with. So by sitting in your house and coming up with ideas, you start gaining these claims, partial ownership claims to property already homesteaded and owned by other people. This is the very problem that it undercuts the basis for private property rights.
I just want to go back briefly to the question before. One of the issues is you have land, and let's say you have somebody who owned the land previously, but in the meantime a structure has been erected on the land. You cannot physically separate one from the other. In this situation, the old landowner and the new construction owner, so to speak, there is no other possibility but that they have to bargain. And obviously they have an interest in coming to a quick conclusion in this, because after all, one cannot really sell anything without the other. But there is no other solution but a bargain in this case. What part of the ownership should go to the landowner, what part of the ownership should go to the newly erected structure on the land that originally belonged to someone else. But there is no other solution but to bargain. But because they both have an interest, so to speak, to come to a quick solution, I
I think judges, arbitrators in this case would come up very quickly with mutually beneficial solutions to the problem.
Yes, I would like to challenge some statements, or at least raise questions that statements made about German economic development before the First World War. Basically because I found them very strange, having read many, many books on German history this period over the last 40 years. From what I gather, although Germany may not have closed the industrial gap with England, it came very close to doing this by the First World War. During the war, its industrial output is greater, which is not surprising. I'm unaware of Kaiser Wilhelm ever making the statement that Russia is going to creep up on us and we have to go to war before they do. He was concerned about the disproportion in military, the availability of military men, because the draft in France was much much greater, was more intensive than in Germany. The tax rate in Germany was probably the lowest in Europe, despite the fact that there were social programs under Kaiser. It's something like between 5% and 7%. There's a book by Eberhard Schrau on Kaiser Wilhelm II that came out last year, which deals with economic development in this period. Unfortunately, it's not been translated to English. There also is the fact that many of those institutes which supported scientific research came from private sources. They certainly were not entirely state-funded. One can, of course, complain about cartelization in Germany or in the United States in this period. But there were private industrial benefactors, primarily, that gave money to the institutes that were doing scientific research. In any case, those are all the critical points that I'm raising.
Yeah. Thank you for that. It was on the 21st of June 1914 that the Kaiser told the banker Max Warburg that he was contemplating an early war, because Germany's economy was falling behind relative to his potential enemies, and he was losing his window for victory. And you're absolutely right, by the way, about the growth and the invasion and private funding for research in Germany, which is not often talked about as much as it should be. The key is this business of anecdotes. The wonderful thing about Angus Madison's data is it's quantitative, it's not anecdotal. And you simply have to look at the data, and Germany simply failed to converge on Britain. And it didn't even do a particularly good job on nearly converging on Britain. The French did a better job, paradoxically. And I think that the difference between anecdote and Angus Madison's quantitative data is, I find, very interesting. Germany, of course, is a much bigger country. So although it's lower in terms of GDP per capita than Britain, it has a significantly larger population. And so in total, it becomes more powerful than Britain. But relatively, I think Madison's data is surprisingly interesting and really goes against so much of the anecdote. That's what I would say in reply. But we shouldn't disagree. We should look at the facts which neither of us have in front of us. And Madison could prove you right or me right. I haven't got the facts in front of me. But I'm pretty sure that's what he says. But we don't have to argue. We should refer to Madison, who knows more than anyone else. Can we agree to disagree on that?
Yes.
Yes, I have a question for Professor Kiel. I'd like to draw a link between your presentation and that of Nikolai Gurdjieff yesterday regarding economic Nobel Prizes. So what can you say about the destruction of economic science by government funding?
I very much regret why I was punished by Hans to go last, but I wasn't here yesterday. Was this the talk on who wins economic Nobel Prizes? I read the title and I was so jealous that I couldn't get to the talk, but I can't comment sadly because I didn't. So I just said no enough about it. But I wish I'd not to talk.
I have no other question about
just a commentary on what Professor Kova said about bargaining for peace and socialization. Because this question emerges all the time in Latin American countries regarding feudal systems in haciendas and farms in general. But of course, the same solution Professor Hoppe has provided applies. because any modification that the descendants of the original owners or homesteaders of the land have done, added subfugal means, have to be subtracted from the modifications that the conquistadores and the Republic era Latin Americans did. Again, it's what we use heritage for. We use experts to ascertain how assets have gained value over time and who owns how much of the improvements.
Yeah, just again, only briefly remark on this. The principle always has to be that he who currently occupies something, the presumption is of course in his favor that he is the owner, unless somebody else can show that he is actually the legitimate owner. It is not sufficient to say the current owner somehow came into the possession that he has right now due to certain crimes that occurred in the distant past. That is practically the case for everything that we ever, any piece of land that is owned, that was somehow acquired, there was some crime occurred in the course of history. But this does not show that some specific other individual has a claim to it. So only if a specific individual can show I have a better claim to this piece of property than the current possessor, by showing records and so forth and detailing the crimes that have occurred in the past, would we want to restore them. So if the Indians say we want to claim that back, or the Italians want to claim certain territories back, that is not sufficient to establish any valid claim. Specific individuals must show that they are actually the rightful owner instead of the person who is currently there. So this is why in these socialist countries we do face tremendous difficulties, because sometimes we simply cannot trace back far enough into the past in order to establish who is the rightful owner, and then we must decide, what do we do with property where no past rightful owner can be established? How do we privatize that? And then I would say those people who currently make use or have made currently use of the property have, of course, a better claim to it than somebody who lives 1,000 miles away.
Comment on Martin Daniel's talk. What you actually highlight is the increasingly strong organization of public life, because we do not like people smoking, it's associated with bad life, so we forbid it. But we like our football teams, and therefore we put on people who are practicing sport. And this is a phenomenon we see increasingly in England, where children get prosecuted for racist comments, where we see civil servants digging your bin bags to see if you recycle properly, and where even if the government has bankers to make money, we prosecute bankers because we approve of people making that much money. I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that.
All I would say is that there's a kind of that kind of moral, not moralization, moralisticization in public life is obviously going on, at the same time as there's demoralization of the private life. So that there's this kind of paradox, and of course as people become more demoralized, so social pathology increases, which gives public authorities more and more superficially more and more reason to interfere. And so they're constantly, our public authorities are constantly chasing the consequences of the bad behavior of our people. But I don't really have anything else to say. Of course, one of the things, another disaster in Britain has been that we have to employ large numbers of people in public administration because we insist on sending so many people to university and they can't really do anything else. And one way to employ them is to interfere in other people's lives.
This is a little bit of a follow-up question, really. Thomas has some of the others made a comment regarding European settlement in the New World. I believe it's a German. Do you think, for example, if we take the case of Manhattan, where that island was born from presumably legitimate moments, and that then Manhattan is legitimately European in the sense that the European settlers bought the land from the original owners, and then necessarily mean the Midwest is then illegitimately in European hands because it wasn't bought, it was conquered. And if I could just think about the conflict in the Middle East that we witnessed with Israel, were the origins of Israel legitimate in the sense of that there were wealthy Jewish charities buying land, the Rothschilds, for example, buying land in Israel from the Ottoman landholders? Does that make the nucleus of Israel is legitimate? Does it make the expansion of Israel illegitimate? How do we grasp these topics? And how do we decide what's legitimate and illegitimate, given our principles on legitimacy of ownership?
Well, my talk had nothing to do with Israel, so I'm not sure what any of your questions had to do with what I actually said in my talk. It wasn't a general discussion of land ownership throughout the world. The point I was making was the U.S. government has false virtue in claiming that what it did during and after the Civil War years was so exceptionally virtuous that it gives it essentially a carte blanche to rule the world, essentially. And this was just one chapter of this book that I was describing. And so I didn't lay out the philosophical or legalistic case for land ownership in it. I was just trying to describe the history. What happened? I didn't make any moral or ethical judgment on who should have owned the land and who shouldn't. I'm just describing what happened as far as that goes. So I'm not sure how useful it would be for me to just speculate on these kind of questions. I wouldn't say the Europeans should not have owned the Midwest because there was some of the land was acquired by purchase. I mentioned that by the 20th century, they spent more than $800 billion on purchasing land, and that including what is some of the Midwest. So it wasn't all through conquest, as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, again, that is different from case to case, and it depends very, very much on what time lag is involved. Who of the Indians, even if they were harmed, some land was stolen, some land was acquired. In any case, who can prove now that they have a better title to the land than those who sit on the land? The closer these events are to the present, the easier it is to figure these disputes out. In the case of Israel, I'm sure there are many Palestinians who can show clear-cut titles to land that was taken away from them. If you go back 100 years, 200 years, it is almost impossible that you can just show the necessary documents that establish you instead of somebody else as the owner.
If I
can
just make a small point, the lady back there, of course, it's a follow-up question to her, so should we, the English, ever have gone to North America? And all I can say is I wrote a piece in Times Higher 3 years ago, in which I pointed out that the original English in the Mayflower people who landed in Massachusetts, and at the same time the English landed in Virginia, and they each landed on land owned by a tribe. And what is extraordinary
Within 9 months of arriving, both sets of English colonists engaged in a genocidal war against that very tribe. And what is also extraordinary is they write back to their sponsors back in England, full of pride in having killed the enemy, and they determined that they were raping and murdering within months of arriving in the North American continent. And their sponsors back in England are shocked at the speed with which they have gone native and savage. It's the most extraordinary thing. So, just look at my name, Times Higher, America, American Savagery. And it is the most extraordinary. The moment we arrived in England, we went from being nice English people to horrible Americans and all the horrible you described.
I was wondering, there's a tendency amongst the English press to say that parents that don't monogamy their children should be prosecuted and should have their children taken away from them because they think it's almost criminal neglect not to vaccinate your child. And I was thinking, do you think that maybe they would take this even further to say that any parent that smokes in the house with a child because there's a proven mark, do you think that the press would take it even further into saying that that should constitute neglect in parents that smoke in front of their kids? Especially since there's evidence that says that parents that smoke have children that are more likely to smoke themselves. Do you think that maybe that should constitute abuse under the current system because they're pushing the boundaries of what constitutes abuse more and more and trying to step into the family and take control over what should be the role of the parent?
I think that's a distinct possibility, and of course, since there's no end to the number of things that can be shown to do good or harm, there's no end to the potential interference. It is already the case, I believe, that it's very difficult for parents who smoke to adopt a child. Smoking is one of the few things that will preclude anyone from being able to adopt. But of course, one of the things about this is that it will always be applied inconsistently according to a preconceived moral conception. I can well see a time when there will be smoke alarms in people's homes and social workers will come and rush in and protect children from smoke from their parents. I think it's well within the bounds of possibility. The other thing I must say is that my experience is that satire is prophecy. So that if you think of a satirical idea within about 10 years, it's actually kind of reality.
I have a question for Professor Holberg, again on the question of property restitution. Years ago, Diane Cole published a paper about the time span and restitution regarding also socialist countries. And this argument was as follows. I want to restrict the restitution to the generation which suffered it, because giving it, accepting the restitution for the next generation, they didn't suffer it as a loss, but they received it as a windfall of profit for themselves. So I don't think that there is anybody here in this room who would support this argument, because this I find it absolutely unethical. But is there, I think we should concretize a little bit this question of time lag. Is it the time lag as such which limits the restitution, or is it the time lag only in the sense that it makes it much more difficult to define the property rights of the family of the restituent? There was an interesting case, a Tsar case, maybe if you want, in the 19th century, when a member of the Wallenstein family went to court and they claimed the restitution of the property of the historical Wallenstein, whose property was confiscated because of a conspiracy emperor. And they had all the papers because this was the family was in possess of all the papers, they did not succeed in this. On the other hand, we have cases of restitution this time spans of more than 300 years for political decisions, for instance, the French Revolution, which restituted property of Huguenots for obvious political reasons. So I would like to give an assessment of this time-lag problem regarding retribution.
So it's not the time lag as such, it's just the time lag makes it practically more complicated. Otherwise, the whole thing would be an attack on inheritance rights. Since I think that it can be justified quite well, this right of inheritance, if we would be able to establish a clear-cut trace that goes back 300 years, I would not be opposed to restoring the original owners, even though these are the descendants of descendants of descendants. Time makes the problem more complicated as a technical, practical affair, but in principle, of course, it is unimportant. Unless somebody takes a right, inheritance is unjust, which I think is a ridiculous position to take, but again, then people would have to take that position. I'm against the right of inheritance. I should mention that also there exist also some famous libertarians, or people who call themselves libertarian, who think there should be no right of inheritance. James Buchanan, for instance, is a typical case. And so is also Patrick Buchanan has also come out against the right of inheritance. In Patrick Buchanan's case, he has no children. That makes sense. I think in James Buchanan's case, he has also no children.
That's right.
It also makes sense.
Two more questions. I think we're closing the list now. It's 5 to 6.
Open question to the panel. The past 3 days, we've heard sort of State of the Union of different areas about the way in which the state intervenes in people's lives. We heard about in banking, the issuance of credit, controlling currencies, the Swiss central bank being able to punch their currency 20% in a matter of days. Workfare Fairback in the time Tom was talking about actually took a lot of men and a lot of bullets in the Capitol. Now you can fly better a drone and wipe out a village in a very efficient in a bad way sense of the word. In health, innovation, the ability to control people's lives through technology, cameras. I was driving on the highway and noticed they don't bother pulling people over. In large part, they issue tickets in states in some areas now. There's just a camera that auto clocks your speed, auto photographs you in the front seat to prove it was you driving the car and your license plate, and you get a ticket in the mail. No human capital required. So I wanted to hear your speculations on where does this lead? You know, I mean, people who are like-minded in this room who tracked the rise in states' destructive abilities and power and the way that technology can be harnessed for bad purposes. Where does it end, and what do you think the trend is?
Well, my view is the state only exists because it is seen as legitimate by most people. So I think over time, if we're more prosperous, people, I mean, like when I always give the example of when Russia, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was a learning experience. Before that happened, most people, you know, really had no idea about communism, whether it was good or bad, except the people suffering. But now there's sort of widespread knowledge among, say, your average American that communism doesn't work. It was a learning experience. Not just the intellectuals or the free market makers know that. So my only hope is that over time, as we continue to have more prosperity, despite the state, the decrease in technology, that people will just sort of gradually become more economically literate and have more money to engage in it. So I think economic literacy is the only hope for humanity. And know, it's being spread. There are many more free market thinkers in Austria and less libertarians now than 20 years ago, 40 years ago. So I think there's some hope, but I don't think it's going to be quick. So I would just say, I think the solution is to laugh at the state, to divide the legitimacy, make fun of the government, treat them as clowns and buffoons, and label them corrupt.
I actually, I'm looking for somebody who is a comedian that could be invited for something like this. I think we would have plenty of talent around her who could act as ghost writers for these comedians. So if you have some suggestion who might be a potential candidate for this sort of stuff, I would be very happy, because this is exactly what I think. Only if people, large masses, simply treat these people as jokes, only then will we succeed in delegitimizing them. Unfortunately, we tend to be all too serious, scholarly types, and are not all that successful. Okay. The Tommy Lorenzo excluded. But again, any suggestion is welcome.
Well, that's, I agree completely about the making fun of, mocking these people, not just them, but the media lapdogs, too, who are talking in power. We had a bit of a controversy in the U.S. Several weeks ago when Ron Paul's son went up in the Senate, and he mentioned that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 did some damage to property rights, and the media went berserk over it. And there was a woman named Rachel Maddow who was on television as her own news show. And I blogged about her, sort of a Dear Rachel letter on the littlerockclub.com blog. And I said, I understand you got your panties in a knot, so Grant Halton. And I got all this hate mail from conservatives saying I shouldn't say things like that. But I adamantly disagree. I think we need to mock and ridicule these people. And I think, you know, people will read this and they get a good chuckle. And next time they see Rachel Maddow on TV, they'll think of the panties in a knot. I wonder what's, you know, what's under there. So that's the reason I do things like this. I think it's important. It's not just being fun, you know, being silly. I think we should seriously use more comedy. In the American case of what's going on is a little, it's pretty kind of interesting because of the constitutionalism of it. But the Constitution no longer, for many years, has any restraint at all on the government. The Republicans use the Constitution to try to stop what the Democrats are doing once in a while, and the Democrats use the Constitution to try to stop what the Republicans are doing, but neither party believes in using the Constitution to limit government. And at least when Bill Clinton was president, he was at least worried about the effects of higher taxes on the bond market. There's a famous example where he wanted to raise taxes for socialized medicine, and his Treasury Secretary said, oh, this would be devastating to the bond market. And then Clinton famously, you know, used a lot of cuss words and decided not to raise taxes. But now, with Obama, not anything goes. Even the hell with the bond market. You don't care about the, you know, $1 trillion-a-year deficit. So there are no restraints whatsoever. But what that has led to is that actually all kind of talk and serious talk about secession and nullification. There are something like 40 states, maybe more than that now, that have issued, at least issued resolutions saying that they intend to nullify laws that they think are unconstitutional, like the socialized health care law that Obama just passed. Nothing may come of it, but Americans are at least waking up to their own history of how they used to do this. They used to nullify laws that they thought were not constitutional themselves. They didn't wait for the Supreme Court. I mean, isn't it a farce that we have a system of where the government sets the limits on its own powers through the Supreme Court? And of course, they did not rule a single law to be unconstitutional in the U.S. from 1937 to 1995. Everything was just peachy keen according to the Supreme Court. But that seems to be turning around. And our friend Tom Woods has a book coming out on nullification at the end of this month, and it'll probably be a big seller. And as our friend Gary North says, you can't fight City Hall, but you can pee on the steps and run away. Maybe that's what we're doing.